Hi, welcome to the Doomer Optimism Podcast. My name is Joe Orso, and I'm going to be your host today. And I'm sitting here in Southwest Wisconsin with my friend Susan Nesbitt. How's it going, Susan?
Great. How are you, Joe?
Good. So Susan works as a death doula, and she helped found an organization called Threshold Care Circle, which does a lot of work that Susan's going to get into, but basically they're empowering families to tend the bodies of their loved ones during the dying process and after death themselves. So they train people to do to wash the body, to do vigils at home with the body, to dig graves, to do home burials, and we're going to get into all of that during this podcast. But I am going to take a moment, if you can bear with me for a little bit, Ashley Colby, because I'm new to the Doomer Optimism community and haven't been on this podcast before. She just asked me to describe my connection to Doomer Optimism and tell a little bit about myself. So I'll do that briefly before we get into the main content of the show. So I have been listening to Doomer Optimism for, I don't know, a couple years. I was introduced to it by Peter Allen, who probably a lot of you know and have heard. He's a regenerative farmer with his wife, Maureen, here in Southwest Wisconsin's Driftless area. And Peter and Maureen and their kids live just over the ridgetop from my family, my wife and myself and our two kids. And we've been good friends with them for quite a while, have learned a lot about tending the land and just tending community in the ways that they do so beautifully. So that's how I got kind of connected to the Doomer Optimism world. And then a few weeks ago, I met Ashley at the Front Porch Republic conference and that Paul Kingsnorth spoke at. And then a week or so later, I went out to Wyoming at the event that Ashley and Paul McNeil and Seneca Scott and James Pogue organized out there. So I got to know some folks and was really inspired and moved by what I encountered out there. So anyway, that's a little bit of my connection to this community. And then a brief introduction to myself. I grew up in St. Louis and had an early career in journalism covering religion and the environment before, like a lot of people, I got disillusioned by the professional kind of ladder climbing world, walked away from all of that, met my wife. We started working on farms, built a tiny house, lived in that for 7 or 8 years, had a couple kids who we now homeschool, and then eventually moved on land with my mom and dad, and we started rebuilding an old dog house. And so we live in that house, we carry in and out our water, don't have electricity, cook on a wood stove. I never say we're like live off grid because we're still tied to the grid in the billion ways that all of us are. But within our tiny little home infrastructure, we do try and experiment with living a little more slowly. So anyway, that gives you a little bit of background on myself. So today, Susan and I are going to talk about death. And Susan and I met a while back. My wife and my mom took a workshop from Threshold Care Circle. This was probably 5 years ago because my dad had had Alzheimer's for many, many years. He began showing symptoms when he was 50, and we knew that his death was coming in the coming years. So we wanted to be prepared. And then my father passed away last winter, and you and the others at Threshold Care Circle were intimately involved in supporting our family on that journey. I want to frame this conversation a little bit before before I hand it over to you and we get into the meat of what we're going to talk about. So why I approached Ashley about doing this podcast was because out in Wyoming, Paul Kingsnorth said two things that really resonated with me and seemed to resonate with others there. And one of them was that of the many, many crises that we are all facing right now, at the heart of them all is a spiritual crisis. And that like really hits home for me. The other thing he said is that we live in this kind of between time or this between world We all know the world that we come from has created a lot of pain and suffering. We can call it the machine age or the industrial age or hell or whatever. And we sense, or a lot of people intuit, that we're moving into something else. But how we get from there, from one place to the other, isn't quite clear. It's not like we can just rationally develop a solution or work out some policy and then go. It's not clear because the work is spiritual and there's deeper movements than we can maybe fully grasp. And so what we have to do is just tend to the daily work of this. So my question leaving Wyoming was like, how do we put that spiritual crisis at the heart of the conversation? And as I wondered about that, one place that I went to is the work that you do, Susan, in death and dying. Because my experience with what you led our family through or supported our family in was similar to the experience that we had with a midwife who supported Adrienne in giving birth to our children at home, which was, it was profoundly transformative on a personal level. And I know that was true for my family, but I also know talking to other people who were at the funeral or who helped dig the grave or who helped wash my dad's body, that it was powerfully transformative for them to be involved in that work together. And so I want to get into this, like, how do we fail at death culturally? How do we fail when we give death over to people who don't know our loved ones? What makes a good death and all of this? So we'll take this conversation in many directions over the next hour or so, but I thought we could just start, by you talking a little bit about how you got into this work, why you became a death doula, how you and the others started Threshold Care Circle, and why. You could just give us some kind of background about your entry points into this work.
Sure. I did not have much experience or interest in death until I was 36 years old. And that was the year 2004, which was the year that my dear friend Freddie died. And I had the great privilege of being at her bedside with two other people. And up until then, I just did not think about or want to contemplate death at all, which seems to be the way of our society. But during her dying process, I witnessed some things that were very confusing to me, upsetting, and I thought could change. And then after her death, I witnessed one of the most beautiful life-transforming events of my life, which was her home funeral. So after Freddie died, her mother wanted to bring her home, and a group of us, a small group of people in the community, planned, organized, and held a home funeral, which none of us knew what we were doing, but it was a very profound event in our community and left many of us curious. And, well, in an odd way, deeply satisfied, which is a little strange to say, but we definitely knew that there was a way to do death differently, to approach death differently, and so we started to have community conversations. And that those conversations ultimately led to forming Threshold Care Circle in 2006. Prior to that, though, because I had the privilege of being with Freddie, I knew that I wanted to be involved in the dying process because, as you so eloquently spoke, it is a spiritual experience and something that I knew I wanted to dig into. So I became a hospice volunteer in 2005. And then once my children were grown and out of the house many years later, I really wanted to look at how I could be a healing presence for the dying in a deeper way. So I went to the Conscious Dying Institute and became a certified death doula and followed that with going to school at the Sacred Art of Living Center, where I've been studying in the Anamkara apprenticeship program. So that's how I got into the doula work. And I would say that, yeah, it's a spiritual path that I'm very, very privileged to be a part of.
And what, so when you talked about that first experience of the home funeral being profound or transformative, mm-hmm. like, yeah. can you dig into that a little bit
sure.
and say how?
Yeah. Well, first of all, just bringing a body back home was revelatory. I did not know that was legal. And yet, once we had her in the home, it was this unbelievable, natural feeling. Like, of course, why wouldn't we do this? So how did we get her home? Well, we transported her body, which was a story in and of itself. But we also, a few of the people in the community built her casket. That right there, the hands-on work of doing that is the beginning of healing. And so what I saw through the process was people building a casket, people beautifying the space, people preparing, lining her casket and dressing her, people making food, getting ready for a circle where we honored Freddie in a very organic way that took a lot of time, actually, because there was a big circle of people and everybody who wanted to speak could speak. There was dancing, there was singing, and we were able to experience death in without any time frame. There was not this 2-hour, we're at the funeral home, go and say your words and be done. We really just took our time, and that was just a really big difference from anything any of us had experienced.
Yeah, that was the way it was. So in our family, so I have two older brothers, mm-hmm. and they came to town. And to also have to work out every aspect yeah. of how we're going to tend dad's body together.
Yeah.
Like you mentioned, a casket, you know, like, so we have to sit in a circle as a family
yep.
and discuss, like, how do we want to build a casket? Do we want to use a shroud? Mm-hmm. If we're going to use a shroud, do we want anything on the shroud?
Yeah.
And like we all, like my oldest brother is not religious. My second oldest brother is deeply Catholic. And then I'm somewhere in between. And,
yeah.
And then my mom is Catholic and my dad was. And so yeah. it was just like, we had these really powerful conversations that
right.
got into like a lot of complexities in our family, but because there was this death of this loved one in the middle of them all, they were all beautiful conversations to have to like work those things out together.
Yeah.
Which, you know, you don't have to do that when you're handing it over to someone else.
Yeah. I think that just being involved in whatever way that looks like, for some people that's sitting vigil. For other people, it's flower arrangement. Other people, creating music. Whatever it is, it just, as you witness with your family, it allows us to begin to take back this right that we have, that we've given over to professionals and, frankly, to strangers. So
let's talk a little bit about that. I mean, I want to get into, like, kind of the details of tending our dead ourselves. But can you talk a little bit about your perception of how our culture gets death wrong? And I want to set that up by saying every birth is sacred and every death is sacred.
Yeah.
And so it's like hard to critique the culture
right.
and not feel judgmental. I have friends who've buried their parents or loved ones in many, many different ways. And I know that all of those times they were spiritually powerful for those people.
Absolutely.
So like, I don't want to negate
yes.
experience mm-hmm. on the individual level,
right.
but I do want to be able to talk culturally and like say, we might be missing some things.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what we might be missing or what we might be even corrupting with the way that we handle death.
Well, I'm glad that you started by acknowledging that every death is sacred. And of course, we do not want to stand in judgment of what people do. We'll start there. I will also add that access to end-of-life care is not fair or equal in this country. And I think that that's an important point that we need to remember. Furthermore, not everybody has loved ones or support at the end of life. So we can never just generalize about quote-unquote our culture. And as a white woman able-bodied, straight, white woman, I don't want to speak for anybody other than myself. So that said, I will say that I feel that death has completely gone off the rails in our culture. And we've outsourced death, and it's become a capitalist exchange rather than a sacred transition. Again, we cannot generalize. Certainly, people have sacred situations when their loved one dies. However, I have seen that it's become about money, and in reality, it could be very simple and straightforward and not burdensome financially. So that's one thing. Secondly, I think what we get wrong is that we've allowed death and dying in our culture to become toxic. We embalm bodies unnecessarily. We use concrete vaults unnecessarily, and we often fill our graves with non-biodegradable materials unnecessarily. The other option is cremation, which people tend to think is green, and in reality, it uses a lot of fossil fuel and puts nasty chemicals into the environment. So to me, something that could be very simple and frankly not harmful to the earth has just become very toxic. I also think that we avoid or ignore death at great peril because we avoid having conversations that we could have that would prevent grieving. Not that we can ever fully prevent grieving, but there are many times people die and things are left unsaid. And by not talking about death, we run the risk of not forgiving, not having these conversations, and frankly, not planning and leaving our loved ones to guess what we want. So I see that as an issue. I would also say that our fear of death, which you can see in the glorification of youth, it comes at a real cost. We are so afraid of death and dying, and rather than honoring our elders and rather than celebrating all the seasons of life, we try so hard to stay young, which is impossible. And then we end up at the end of life, and it's so often just devastating to people because they have not faced death in their life. So there's that. I can go on and on. There's the medicalization of death and dying, which I think is tragic. Certainly there's a place for meds, but so often they're overused for the wrong reasons, for prolonging life.
Can you talk a little bit in detail about that? Because that was something came up very intimately during my father's death. And you had spoken to us about it beforehand, but just prepare yourself for the morphine. Because it's what happens. It's like the default in the dying process.
Right.
And that's not to say that you should or shouldn't use morphine again, but that being conscious about what you're doing, that pain or, the body moving in certain ways is not something you just want to shut off with medicine necessarily.
Right.
But it might be. But I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about that.
Well, and
the medicalization.
I think that the medicalization doesn't start right with the death process. It starts much earlier. And we can see how we, in our attempts to avoid death and dying, we numb ourselves. So then when you get to the actual death, it's terrifying. It can be terrifying. And so with morphine, I never stand in judgment of anyone using morphine, but I will often wonder, who is the morphine for? Is the morphine for the person who is dying, or is it for the people who are witnessing suffering? And I feel that if we were having conversations about death and dying much earlier, and it was not this taboo subject, that perhaps the amount of morphine we used at the end of life would decrease. Again, I think that there is a place when someone is writhing in physical pain. Of course, we do not want them to suffer unnecessarily. But the numbing around death, I at the very least think it's something that we should look at with curiosity.
And it mirrors the numbing that we do around birth as well.
Exactly. And throughout life, frankly.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. What makes for a good death?
Well, I wanted to say one other thing about your question about where we go wrong with death. And I would say, as a final point, the fact that we pay the people who take care of our dying, on average, caretakers are paid $23,000 a year, is abysmal. And shame on us, because it's, well.
I mean, yeah, yeah, I'll talk about that a little bit, because my wife, Adrienne, works as a CNA at a memory care facility where we didn't want to put Dad in a memory care facility. Right. I won't go into the long story about why we chose to, but then she immediately got a job there. Mm-hmm. And watching up close the work that she and the other workers do, it is the most, and she is always tending death. Yeah. They are always tending death in that facility. And often, because it's a memory care facility, they're dealing with people who are having very challenging mental experiences or spiritual experiences. The physical work that they do to move people, to clean people, and then to tend them in their death, it is like ongoing. It is, there's no way that I could ever do that work. Yeah. And and it's insane what they're, it is like some of the hardest work in the world, and they're paid very, very little.
Right.
But when you talk to mostly those women who are working, not all women, there's some amazing men who also do that work. But in that facility, it is mostly women. Is like, for a lot of them, it's like, it's vocational work for them.
Yeah.
And it's like, they're caretakers.
They're caretakers.
But it's crazy what they're paid.
It's crazy what they're paid. And then also just, I think that in the medical field, death is seen as failure. And what a shame. What an absolute shame that we would not see death as the natural outcome of being alive. Mm. So that's some of my ideas around how we fail at death. And then as for what makes a good death, that's a complicated question. And again, the caveat that I will not speak for everyone, but for me, a good death will probably involve a lot of sadness and sorrow, which is, of course, often the direct result of love. For me, a good death means living a full life, however short, so that a person dies without bitterness in their heart and without leaving things unsaid. For me, a good death has the potential to bring community together, as you witnessed with your father, and to grieve together so that healing can begin. A good death will involve ritual, from my perspective, because that is, I like to think when I'm dying that I would want ritual to support me and help me on my way out, and also knowing that it helps the people who are involved in caring for the dying to begin their own healing journey. I think that for me, a good death means that the person fully understood their choices and were able to choose what their death would look like and have that support. That said, I think that most people say they would like to die at home, but because of the world we live in and the systems that we have set up, there is not the support for many people to have a home death. And so ideally, we would be at home, but that's actually quite rare.
Mm-hmm. Right. But we can still do a lot of it at home. After death. I mean, that was, that was our experience.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, not everyone is able to, I know, but even if the death itself doesn't occur at home, the tending of the body after death can still happen.
And even, I would say, even if the person is in the hospital, there are certainly situations where people are going to be hospitalized or in memory care or whatever, nursing facility. That does not mean that we cannot have a good death. Good death means different thing to everybody. For some people, that means surrounded by family. For others, that means no thank you. They maybe don't want that. They want to be with their dog or whatever. But I think that even if a person is in a facility, a good death can happen so long as there's been communication about what that person wants and we do our best to honor that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What are the effects you see of doing, of tending our loved ones ourselves? Like, how does it change us?
Oh, well, I've seen it help with the grieving process for sure. Does not in any way take away the reality that your loved one just died. But by empowering people to be involved and to actually touch their loved ones, to care for them the same way that they cared for them throughout their life, rather than the minute they die, the body's gone, and you're left to going from being very involved in this person's life to nothing. I just see that it really does help with the grieving process, and it also empowers people. And I think that particularly if people are at home, there's a different pace, and people can slow down and be present to what is happening versus when the body is quickly removed and you just are out of your mind. It just, everything starts to feel surreal. There's a time and a space with a home funeral that feels very different to me.
Yeah, for us, I mean, it was like, so Dad's dying, we knew he had moved into his dying phase, and that lasted for probably 2 weeks, the like kind of end mm-hmm. of that phase. And my brothers were in and out of town during that. And it was like, yeah, it became very dreamlike, or like, mm-hmm. I feel like in growing up Catholic, we talked about like Kairos time, the sacred time, mm-hmm. and doing all of those things ourselves, like that's what it became for our family and our friends. It was like, everyone was just mostly sleeping in Mom's house. Mm-hmm. She was sleeping, you know, in a recliner next to Dad for 2 weeks. And, you know, friends were showing up and helping us dig a grave. The kids are present for all of it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when Dad died, like, so Dad died the evening of his birthday. Mm-hmm. He turned 69. And it was like the middle of a blizzard. And all these friends, like, braved these rural country roads and showed up at the facility. And Adrienne, you know, cleaned Dad's body with one friend while my aunts and uncles and my mom and kids all said the rosary in the room. Mm-hmm. And then everybody helped us carry him out of the facility, singing songs, as you had suggested. And mm-hmm. as you had said, like, make sure you bring him out the front door and mm-hmm. not the back door. Usually, mm-hmm. like, at facilities, they bring the dead right. out the back door because right. they hide it.
Yeah.
And it's really important to honor it by bringing mm-hmm. him out the front. And so we had a line of people singing as we carried him out into the snow. Mm-hmm. And then a long caravan drove home, you know, with our flashers and darkness and a blizzard. And then we, you know, brought him into Mom's basement and laid him there. And for, I think, 4 nights and 3 days and 1 morning, people just came in and out of the house around the clock to sit with his body and to pray with him and to sing with him. And our family would be in and out and chatting with folks as that mm-hmm. was happening.
Yeah.
And all of the stories that came out of that experience, like over and over and over, it was like, I've never been in that much like sacred, like mind mm-hmm. collectively for so long. It was so profound. And it was like, the stories that people were doing healing work with the deaths of their own loved ones in those yes. spaces. Like
yes.
people would weep and weep and weep as they sat with my dad's body. Mm-hmm. And we would chat and they would talk about the death of their parent. Mm-hmm. And, or, you know, or the prayers that they would share. Or like, we had my dad's old Bible in the room. And someone found, like, he had highlighted these 3 passages in this Bible that none of us had ever seen before. We're like, well, why did he highlight these? So we read those at his funeral, mm-hmm. and they were all really profound passages. And yeah. it was like, through all of these stories and through all these experiences, what it felt like at the end of it is that we were getting to know this other dimension of dad. Mm-hmm. Like, I feel like I got to know my dad through the funeral ceremony and through his, like, all of these rituals and all of these stories that happen in a way that, like, I didn't know him before that time. And it was because of just, like, this whole collective tending of his body and his spirit and all these prayers that happened around him from people from, like, very different, like, spiritual and non-spiritual, whatever, religious backgrounds. Mm-hmm. But, like, when there's someone who died, like, all of our, like, whatever, cultures and conceptions and stuff, it, like, falls away. And there was just this, like, really beautiful experience of being a human being in a holy world. And, like, wow. And one of the things that, like, really, I feel like, guided us through that whole experience was what you told us at the very beginning. It was before Dad had died. And Adrian and I were like chatting and we're like, gosh, are we going to know how to clean his body? I don't know. I think, you know, Adrian's very, very capable person, tending bodies. But she had never cleaned someone after they had passed. And I was like, well, maybe I should call Susan. I don't know. Maybe someone from Threshold Care Circle could come like be with us just in case. I worry about everything. So she's like, okay, yeah, maybe call Susan. So we call you and, of the many, many things you said to us over those days, like one of the key things that you said in that conversation was, we can be there if you need us or if it helps you feel comfortable. But it's also important for you to know that you don't need us, that you know how to do this.
Yeah.
Just like your wife, when she was in the birthing process, knew exactly what to do. And it was the same message that our midwife, by the way, said to Adrian over and over and over as we prepared for the birth, was, your body will know what to do when you get there. Trust your body. We're here to support you. But trust your body. Mm-hmm. You can do this. Women forever have done this, and you will too. And it was that message that you gave us. Like, when the time comes, you'll know what to do. It's a very human thing,
yes,
to tend the body of people we love after they die. And it'll just be there right in your, like, cellular memory. And it, like, that was totally true. I mean, yes. I didn't do the cleaning. Adrienne and Amy did the cleaning, and it was so profound. And every step of the way after that was like, I mean, there's like, obviously, you know, questions and fumbling, like, how do we do this or that? But we worked it all out, and you just, like, it wasn't difficult at all. It was all very, like, common sense and profound. So anyway, I don't know. That was a long ramble. I don't know where I began that, but
I don't know, but thank you for sharing. That's so wonderful. And I would say that one of the things that I witnessed with your father's death, and I was a peripheral, I was on the periphery for sure, was how you really took up ritual. And I had suggested that at every step of the way, you can infuse meaning. And your family did that so beautifully. And I loved hearing how you did the body washing, which of course is in our bones and we know how to do. But then you followed that with the singing and then the vigil, sitting with your dad and reading and hearing these stories. And what a healing experience. And of course, still so incredibly sad. But I witnessed, being at your dad's funeral, how the community, I could see it happening in front of my eyes. The community was coming together in this very profound way. And to go back to the beginning of our conversation, we are so lacking a spiritual path right now. And I feel like in some ways we're in a pandemic of loneliness. And when the community has an opportunity to come together, wow, we're so happy to help each other. But there's less and less opportunity for that because everybody's running around doing their own thing, trying to get by in this crazy world. But witnessing your dad's funeral and many others like it, it is so healing.
Right.
And so beautiful.
Yeah, people like want to take care of each other.
They do.
We want to be there for each other. Mm-hmm. And like how it happens in birth and death, it's like you actually really need tons of support if you're going to do it without professional help without paying a ton of money to have others do it. And it's like, but people just show up with, you know, without asking and honoring it as like a gift. Like so many times people are like, thank you for this. Like the people who showed up to dig the grave, you know, were like thanking us for, you know, allowing them to be part of it or whatever, which for us, we were just like, thank you so much for coming to be a part of it. But it's like, you're all just in this like amazing experience of gratitude together.
Yeah.
And it's weird because it's like the saddest thing in the world when,
right.
when someone dies. But it's also for us, it was like, it was really joyful as well. And that was one of the surprising things about it.
In some ways it's a relief to know what to do because people often want to help, but we've handed everything over. There's nothing to do. Okay, you can bring a casserole. Big deal. In the end, though, to actually wash a body, to actually dig a grave, to actually sit with a dead person, which, by the way, I imagine sounds quite foreign and maybe a little scary to many people. I never could have imagined it. And yet, what a gift. Mm. It's the antithesis of our culture. Talk about slowing down.
Right.
There is nowhere to go. And you are just faced with what is present and true, and that is death. So we have this opportunity when there's a death. And certainly, I think we need to say that we're very lucky because we live in a rural area where this can happen, this kind of thing can happen. But there's versions of this that can happen in the city. And to me, I think the big thing is how can we infuse ritual, whatever that looks like. I'm not talking about a certain religion or spiritual path. I'm saying anything we do with intention, that's ritual. So how can we put intention back into the death and dying process?
So why do you encourage vigils with the body?
Well, I think that we don't know what happens. None of us know what happens when we die. But if there's the possibility that the person is transitioning to another place, in some religions, there's the belief that people need encouragement and support to get there. So why wouldn't we offer that? That's one reason. Even if you don't believe it, you can suspend that thought for a moment and just say, what if? So there's that. But I also think that sitting vigil allows us to, again, slow down and really process what is happening. Because there you are with the reality of death. It's not a 2-hour time slot in a funeral home where a person's embalmed. It's a dead body right there. And so it's this deeply sacred time that so many of us don't get the opportunity to have. But I would say, if you ever do have the opportunity to sit vigil, do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I second that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like I was saying, the stories that people would share with us after sitting vigil.
Yes.
Were just like, you know, the night before my dad's funeral, you know, Adrian and I are like sleeping on the couch in the basement, and dad's, you know, the vigil is in a bedroom in the basement, and, you know, it's like 3 a.m. and you're kind of bleary eyed, and a close friend who's also a midwife shows up at the door, you know, and then like later you hear chanting and singing coming from that room. I mean, it's to have those experiences to do the opposite of what the culture does,
right.
which is ignore death, but to actually like just sit with it for days,
right,
and to gaze at it in a really like embodied way. It's, you know, we're talking, but it's really hard to put words around its effect personally and for like all of us who do it in a circle. It's like, or digging the grave, you know.
Yeah. I think also sitting vigil, I would say for any parent who loses a child and frankly, anybody who loses a loved one. The thought that their loved one is being tended to around the clock and held in this beautiful space, as you just said, a person showed up at 3 a.m. And that is what we do in this community, in the home funeral community. We often have either 24 or 3-day vigils where there are sign-up sheets and people tend that body. And it is extremely comforting to the family. That I can say for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, the last day of the vigil, we had a time slot that hadn't been filled. And what, you know, we were just going to sit. But then a friend who, you know, we're not close friends, but they're a friend. We hadn't seen her for a while. And she was like days away from giving birth. Mm. And she called our other friend who was organizing the vigil schedule and was like, hey, you know, I heard Jim passed. Can I, and that there's a vigil. If you need anyone, I would love to come sit. And so I go to answer the door and there's this young woman in her mid-20s, just fully mm-hmm. pregnant and says, I know I didn't know your dad very well, but I heard people were coming to pray with him and I wanted to sit with him. And it's just like very, very powerful to see see like both ends
the circle of life
spectrum, like there at once. And, you know, and like that's an image mm-hmm. or a relationship that's like, yeah, that's really strengthened in that moment. So anyway, yeah. How has all of this work changed you? I was like being with death. I mean, mm-hmm. I think about that sometimes. I remember when Adrienne gave birth to our first child and it was just so, you know, we're talking about death now, but yes. Like birth, we could have the same conversation. It's so powerful. And then you're like, wait, this midwife has done this like more than 500 times. She's been with like hundreds of families in this space over and over. How does that shape her? And I'm mm-hmm. curious how this work shapes you.
Yeah. I think the primary answer to that is it has helped me to accept that I do not know a lot of things and that it's okay to not know. I think that certitude in our culture is tearing us apart. People think they are right and they know. And in death, we just don't know. And so I've come to some acceptance around that. And I think that that's softened me and mm-hmm. helped me to become a more compassionate person. It's definitely deepened my spiritual life, changed my whole life, really. And I am much more grateful for every day. Because when you are around death and dying, you really get to see this is not a dress rehearsal, so time to enjoy what you have.
Mm. Mm-hmm. How has it deepened your spiritual life?
Well, that's such a good question. It's just sent me down a path of curiosity about God and the great mystery and why we die and why we are alive. And that has led me to a deep spiritual practice every day of gratitude and compassion and living for the moment. And a lot of that comes directly as a result of working with death and dying.
Hmm. So we've been talking about all this as if it's legal. Which it is here. Mm-hmm. Is it generally all of the things that we're talking about possible? You know, because people probably listen to this from many different states.
No, it is not legal everywhere. So people do need to use a funeral director in some states. And I do not know which states they are. But you can find information at the National Home Funeral Alliance website. Certainly, people need to look at what their state laws are and then what their county laws are. So, for instance, in our county here in Vernon County, you can bury on your land. That is not true everywhere. But there is no law against home burial in the state of Wisconsin. So you do need to dig around a little bit and find out in your state what is legal. And I think, unfortunately, that some states require a funeral director, which I find absurd, but that's the reality.
So what would you say? So, like, culturally, we talk about, like, the losses that come with death, and certainly, like, there is loss. But how would you describe the gifts that you see coming from death? I don't know even if you might have a story that you could share. Not, I'm putting you on the spot. I know I didn't tell you to ask that. But I wonder if you have any stories of a death that you would feel comfortable sharing that that might reveal some gifts of
sure. Okay, well, I'll start with the story of a death that happened just recently in our community. And it touches on my work as a doula and a home funeral educator and green burial advocate. So kind of encompasses all of that. A family asked me to come out and talk to an elderly couple that in their 90s that lived on a farm. And they wanted me to come as a doula to talk about end-of-life plans, what would happen if one of them got sick and how they would proceed and what their plan was for death and dying. And this came at the request of the daughter, who also lives on the farm. So I went out there, and we had a wonderful conversation, and I mostly listened. I found out what their plan was and what their concerns were, and I was able to talk to them about some ideas, including I found out that they were planning on being cremated because it was their understanding that that was a green way to die. So once I let them know that that was not true and then informed them that they could in fact be buried on their farm, they were very interested. Now this came as a shock to the daughter who had heard for years, decades, that mom and dad want to be cremated, done. So that's not why she was having me out there. That was just a conversation that unfolded. So we ended up talking about that. And then months later, they asked me to come out and they wanted to show me where they had chosen for a potential green burial site, for a burial site. So I went out there and, yep, looked like a great spot for the burial. And then we talked about the nuts and bolts, how to dig the grave, how to lower the body, etc. And then the day came that the man, the older man, went into the hospital. And I will say that this was his worst nightmare. He did not want to be in the hospital. And it was a bit of a trial to get him home. But they did get him home and got him on hospice. And his death was not easy. His death was quite upsetting to the family. He had a hard time with breathing. So that happened. But after he died, they called me and wanted to check in about how to proceed with keeping the body at home. So I walked them through without having to go there. I did go there, but more as a friend and just to check in. But really, I just walked them through over the phone what to do with the technique ice, how to lay out the body. And they proceeded to care for this man in the most beautiful way. And it was life-changing for all of them. So what ended up happening was they were able to keep him home, and they just chose a 24-hour, about a day, maybe a day and a half long vigil. The family dug the grave, and then the gift of this, what I wanted to share with you, was that his wife told me that her parting memory from the whole thing was watching her husband lowered into the grave while her children, their children, grandchildren, and even great-grandchildren all held the blanket that lowered him. And she said, that image is in my mind and witnessing my family stepping up and taking care of everything in this loving, beautiful way has made me feel so much better about my own death.
Mm-hmm.
So that was an incredible gift to witness.
Oh my goodness.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, the part that we haven't spoken of is that, like, historically, and maybe even now, still, I mean, most deaths happened like this. Like, the professionalization of death is a recent phenomenon.
Very recent. Less than 150 years.
Like, in the Amish community around here, this is very normal. It's nothing that they had to, like, work out because they've always done it this way and they never stopped doing it this way. Yeah. They have vigils at home. They have funerals at home. They all know how to dig graves in the winter and everything. It's just, like, the norm. And so it's, like, been this missing thing. But then, you know, someone experiences it once and it's like, oh.
Yes. That's
this
what
is how it's supposed to be. Yes. It's so simple.
And I think that because as we were talking earlier, we're so afraid of talking about death that when you start talking about this, keeping a body at home, oh, wow, you're really pushing people's buttons. They think it sounds really weird and maybe a little scary, whatever they're thinking. But I can assure them that if they experience it, they will be changed.
Mm-hmm.
And I've witnessed that now over and over again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I've talked to friends who, like, had the thought that it was not necessarily with my dad, but there's been other home funerals in our community who was like, you know, thought it would be very, very strange and then went and they were like, oh, that was very powerful. That wasn't strange at all.
Yeah. And it might even feel strange, but ultimately, I do see the power of the healing.
Mm.
And once you get past the, oh, this is really different than what I'm used to, and you can settle in, you can really just have a very profound experience. I certainly had that at your father's funeral, and I'd love if you would share about lowering your dad into the grave, because that was really something to witness.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Thanks. Yeah. So we had gone over a lot of the practical steps with you, and you had talked to us about how people generally lowered a body into the grave.
Mm-hmm.
But we were still like just trying to work it out. And there was one night when Adrienne and me and my brothers and my mom and our kids were, and her dog were all in the room with dad while he was still breathing. And I think Adrienne YouTubed lowering. We don't spend a lot of time on, we don't have internet in our house or anything. But anyway, you're sitting there for days and days. And she looked up like, well, how are we going to do this? So she found a YouTube video. These people stepped into the grave and lowered the body by just, some people were out of the grave and they kind of handed the body two people who are in the grave, and we're like, oh, that looks really simple. Let's do it like that. Just practically, it looked like it made sense to us. We could, and so we held the funeral in my mom's basement. A friend of our family, who's a Jesuit priest, said the funeral mass, and then everyone processed. There's like maybe 80 people. We processed out of the house to the grave site in the woods, and and we laid dad's body on the ground on some pine boughs next to the grave while people made prayers and lit incense and sang. And then Jimmy and Matt and myself and a friend of ours hopped into the grave while people are continuing to sing and pray. And to be standing in your father's tomb with your brothers while this whole community of friends and family are praying and singing and surrounding the space in incense, we weren't necessarily prepared for how surreal and there's no words for what that was, but it's an imprint that my brothers and I like have talked about since, like I fail at words to say what that was like. And then to receive dad's body, some of the friends were out of the grave and they handed us dad's body and then we laid him gently on the ground. It was very, Yeah, it was really powerful. And then the whole community after that, we had shovels, we had piles of soil at either end of the grave. And my nephew, who's like 8 years old, did a ton of shoveling.
Yeah.
Like everybody took turns, but like Gabe would not stop. He was just, he was really, and I think he wasn't just having fun. He knew what was happening.
Yeah.
At the end of it, when he handed his shovel over, he grabbed a pile of rocks and asked Adrian, he said, would you put these in a cross over Grandpa when the shoveling is done?
Mm.
There was also a moment during that that people were, I don't know if you saw this or not, but people were shoveling soil over his body and it was piling up, but no one would put soil over his face.
Mm. I did not see that.
It was just like piling up in all around it, but no one, and so Adrienne called me over and she whispered, she's like, Joe, no one can shovel dirt onto his face. They just, nobody can do it. And I was like, she said, you have to reach in there and push soil over his face with your hands for us to like move forward. And I was like, you're totally right. So we did that. And then, and then the grave filled up evenly.
Yeah.
But like all these little things. And just to like, what is that about? What is it about like the face that no one could bring themselves, like everybody there, all the kids, all the adults, no one could bring themselves to do it. It was, I don't have any answer.
And I don't know if you could comment on this, but it's been my experience that filling in a grave is a gift. When you asked about what is a gift, because there is a finality to it that is unlike anything.
Right.
I mean, did you experience that?
Oh my gosh. Yeah. It was like a full release it's a lot of like emotional and spiritual and physical work that you're doing for weeks as you get up to that point, and then to see the body covered up, it's the most embodied form of closure that you can think of. So yeah, it was, and after that it was like, you know, I just remember my mom walking arm in arm with someone and just like smiling as everybody walked back to the house, and you know, to stand around the fire and eat food and hang out and just like celebrate in the afternoon or just be together. And it was like the once the body is buried, there is like a serious transition that happens for everyone.
The other story, if you don't mind sharing quickly, is what I witnessed at your dad's funeral with the children at the end, because that was really magical.
It was, yeah. Sure. Yeah. So you and I were standing on the hillside as like the grave site was filling up, and we were kind of whispering back and forth. And I just remember you saying something like, you know, you don't have to have an ending, but you might want to think through how this ceremony is going to come to a close. Like sometimes people lay flowers on the grave or something to like, you know, and we hadn't thought of anything. Everything is just like kind of emerging organically at that point. So I whispered to Adrienne like, hey, you know, do you want to grab some flowers? And she went to the vigil room where people had like sent flowers, and we had them around that room, and she brought out an armful. And then the shoveling was over and she was just sitting there. And she was reflecting to me afterwards. She's like, how do you, I don't know, like, she was wondering for a moment, like, how am I going to lay flowers? What's, like, the proper way or what? And then she just looks up, and her friend's, I think, like, 4 or 5-year-old kid is just, like, looking at her wide-eyed with a hand out to her. And Adrienne just hands Asa Rose a flower. And Asa Rose goes and just sets it on the grave. And then just every kid there just goes straight to Adrienne and like has their hand out, and she's just handing them flowers one by one as they go and lay it on the grave and then circle back to her. And as they're doing that, our neighbor just starts doing that chant, Ubi Laetate Deo.
Yeah.
And everyone just like joins in this very quiet chant while the kids laid flowers on the grave, and the chant came to like a quiet close, and everybody
so beautiful.
Just like exited. And it again came back to what you said, which is you'll know what to do and people know what to do.
Yeah.
there's like, you don't have to orchestrate everything.
Yeah.
It's in our bones.
Yep.
And when you come together, it'll happen. And it was like over and over, like, oh yeah, yeah, this is totally normal.
Yeah. Yeah, it was incredible.
Yeah. It's, so anyway, yeah, thanks. We're kind of coming to a close here, maybe. Mm-hmm. But before we do, I have two last questions. And one is, I wanted to note that you don't take money for your work as a death doula. And I wonder if you could talk about why that is, or talk about
yes,
that a little bit.
Yes, I would
bit.
Love to. I will start by saying that it is not because I don't think that the work should be valued. And as we spoke earlier, people who take care of those who are dying should be rewarded monetarily. However, that said, I also talked earlier about the fact that death has become corrupt in our culture. And I am very privileged that I can offer these services as a gift to our community. I find that money muddies the waters. So it is my great privilege to be able to just offer my services as a doula as a gift. And I will also say that all of us in Threshold Care Circle and the Driftless Green Burial Alliance are volunteers. We've never taken money for our work. We do not act as funeral directors. Our mission is to empower people. Our goal is to put ourselves out of business, because what we envision is that enough people know how to do this, and we reclaim this, and it just becomes normal. And it's what we do. So we do this with the goal of educating people and hoping that they will take it up. Mm. But we do not take money.
Mm. That's beautiful. Thank you. Yeah, and I feel like it gets, yeah, it's like, we still live in a world where money
yes.
is like dominates social relationships.
Yes.
And so it's understandable that some people might pursue this work and there will be monetary exchange.
Yes.
But in terms of like looking forward to the world that's coming, hopefully we can develop social relationships that organically, you know, where there's give and take without monetary exchange. And so when there's spaces where we can cultivate that, it's really worth doing
yeah.
it. And I love that aspect, both of like your work as a death doula and just knowing that there's this circle of volunteers in our community who are supporting people doing what my family experienced, but
yeah.
that there's no like money exchange happening.
Yeah.
It's all just like human to human support. It's
yeah.
really powerful.
Well, and I will just say, I feel I am paid millions and millions of dollars. The fact mm-hmm. that I get to be involved in this sacred transition with families and individuals is such a gift. So lucky me.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, of the many, I mean, I think I've said to you before, there's so much like beautiful work happening in the world,
there
you know,
is.
Trying to regenerate culture, regenerate families,
mm-hmm.
regenerate prayer. But what I experienced that like you all are doing at Threshold Care Circle is some of the most profound culturally transformative work that I've encountered, to just like go through that experience, not only personally, but with this whole community of people and all of us coming out of it like, whoa,
yeah,
what was that? Let's do that
yep.
the next time. Because there's like much more that happened than we can put words to.
Yeah.
And it felt like, yeah, anyway.
Yeah, it's hopeful because I think that we're seeing that all of the systems that we've developed from birth on need to be reworked. We need to re-envision how we're doing this. And so when you experience a home funeral, it's one aspect of a way that we can empower ourselves. And it's going back, but it's also moving forward. And
mm-hmm.
to me, it's a bit of a revolutionary act.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So is there anything before we come to a close that you want to say, or anything we didn't get to that you want to bring up?
I guess I would just say that if people have questions about home funerals or green burial, they can go to our website, which is thresholdcarecircle.org. And I would also suggest the National Home Funeral Alliance, which has a wonderful manual that the team there has put together to help communities form death care committees or groups. That's very helpful. And if people are interested in doula work, there's the National End of Life Doula Alliance, NIDA.org. That would be helpful. And people can feel free to reach me through the Threshold website. I'm happy to talk to anybody, anytime, about any of these topics. So I guess I'd say that, and maybe just end with this little Mary Oliver, part of a Mary Oliver poem.
That sounds really good. I think we should just end it with those words. So I'm just going to, before you read the poem, say thanks for joining us here on Doomer Optimism. This has been my first time hosting, and it's been fun chatting with you, Susan. My name is Joe Orso. This has been Susan Nesbitt. And I write about our family's home funeral experience on a Substack, which is called The Oar and the Umbrella, as well as other things. I just started it this fall, but just in case anyone's interested, I throw that out there. So thanks a lot for being brave and chatting about all this, Susan. And we'll end with a poem.
Thank you for having me. And I will just say, if you have not checked out Joe's Substack, The Oar and the Umbrella, I highly recommend it. He puts words to the home funeral experience that are so beautiful. Okay, so this is from Mary Oliver, and it is from the Blackwater Woods poem. It's just a section of that poem. To live in this world, you must be able to do three things: to love what is mortal, to hold it against your bones, knowing your life, your own life depends on it, and when the time comes to let it go, to let it go.
Thanks, Susan.
Thank you, Joe.